BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Today we're focusing on the life of one of the great blind all-rounders, historian, author, sportsman, and most significantly for In Touch listeners, ardent campaigner on behalf of blind and partially sighted people, Dr. Fred Reid, who died a few days ago after a short illness. Fred, as we all knew him, was also a regular contributor to this programme. Most of today's story will be told by Fred in his own words, alongside his wife of almost 60 years, Etta. But first, a couple of the people who worked with him and knew him well. First, Professor Ian Bruce, who was Director General of the RNIB between 1983 and 2003 and worked alongside Fred at a time when the attempts to get better financial provision for blind people were at their height.
I think for me, Fred, above all, was a kind and a fair man, but he certainly spoke as he saw things. He was very much a gifted leader of blind people, and I think what everyone would agree, he had a formidable intellect, which he applied both strategic and tactically. In the late 60s and early 70s, RNIB faced him as a formidable negotiator, increasing the proportion of representatives, blind people, in RNIB's executive council. And then that allowed him from then on to concentrate as a constructive elected member of the RNIB governing body. And that's indeed how I met him. I arrived as the chief exec of RNIB as a relative newcomer in the world of blindness and partial sight. And he immediately invited me to come and stay with Etta and three teenage children to see how blind parents of sighted children lived. And you can see that's an example of his kindness, inviting me there, and his thoughtfulness, because obviously it was strategically quite advantageous for him, because he had me for 48 hours to brief me and guide me on what he thought I should be doing in my job. And it formed really almost the basis of our friendship, which lasted over 40 years. I shall miss him. He's a man of great charm, and I just hope I can be like he was as he drew to the end of his life.
Ian Bruce. But alongside Fred's campaigning was his busy working life as a historian and administrator at the University of Warwick. Professor Chris Reid knew him for most of that time and is now completing Fred's autobiography.
The thing about Fred is he wasn't a big guy in terms of stature, but he was an enormous presence. I think he was one of the most well-known people around the campus. He managed to conduct a career in which he made absolutely no allowances to himself for his blindness, and was able to excel in all the areas that academics do. He did first-rate research. He was an extremely popular teacher. And he threw himself into management, which, of course, is something some of us would consider semi-suicidal anyway. It was just extraordinary how he managed to deal with all these things. History is about reading. It's about reading, 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 and doing even more reading. You've got archives, you've got secondary sources, you've got books. You've got journals. He had an endless number of extremely willing volunteers who would record items for him. The technology in those days was basically cassettes, and his room was absolutely awash with cassettes. How he even managed to keep control of where they all were, I don't know. He used Braille a lot for himself as well, of course, in addition to that. But he was also very appreciative of the new technologies coming in right until the end, and he was writing his memoirs, as you may know. I mean, as late as January, he and I were having our regular fortnightly meeting of tea and cakes and all the rest of it with no idea of what was to come.
Professor Chris Reid. But to get the story from the man himself, I sat down with Fred and his wife, Etta, also blind, back in 2018. What followed was a delightful insight, not only into Fred's work, but their life together, the family.
I recall being taken into the Latin class at the Royal Blind School in 1952, wasn't it, Etta?
Yes, I think it was 52.
That's right. I'd never done Latin before, so I had some catching up to do. So the teacher asked me to come and sit at the front. And behind me there was this girl that I thought had a very nice voice, and I rather fancied her. And I thought, oh, I must get to know her.
And how old were you then? You were both
just going on 15,
right? And what did you think of him, Etta?
Well, to begin with, I thought he had a very strange voice. I mean, I was a Glaswegian as well, but he kind of...
I talked down my nose in that Glasgow way at that time.
Well, he was, you know, not very nice.
That would be intriguing to people who will think, blind people, surely they must go on The Voice. That would be very...
Yeah, that's right, you do go on The Voice to begin with. Yeah. But then I discovered that he was very interesting. And the Latin teacher went away on a course, so every time we were supposed to have Latin, Fred and I talked all the time. talk. And to begin with, he was speaking about the anatomy of the eye, because he had recently gone blind. He had detached retina. And of course, I'd been blinded in a road accident, but I didn't know anything about the anatomy of the eye.
It's not very romantic stuff, this, is it?
No, no.
That came later. I won't tell you too much about that.
This was in the classroom.
Right, you had to keep it clean in the classroom.
That's right, yeah. That was it.
Tell me a bit about the school, because you were at the Edinburgh Blind School. What was that like?
Well, it was a very Victorian institution. You know, the Victorian society was far from dead in Britain in general, but especially in Scotland. And you just were not allowed to get at all close to one another. The rule was you can talk, but you can't touch. And Etta used to sing to me, please keep your distance, 6 feet is your distance, because you know my resistance is low.
That was a bit of a come on, Etta, wasn't it?
No, not really.
But, of course, we found ways of subverting the rules and the attempts to keep us all apart. We had dancing. We could get together in the library. That's where we first actually clicked. It was in one of the library sessions, I remember. But as I say, it was very much on the basis that you could talk. But if you were seen in making any kind of amorous advance, you were up on the carpet the next day. And by God, you got it hot.
And obviously that was partly because they were kind of afraid, presumably, of what might happen. But was there also this sense of blind people, you know, it not being a good idea, even in the long term, for them to get together?
Oh, yes. I mean, I was always being lectured by the head. And one of his lines was, the most important decision, read that you will take in your life as a girl you should marry, and I would hate you to have to be committed to marrying a blind girl. It was made very clear to you that that was not in your best interest, and I just thought it was daft. I couldn't see the point of it.
We talked about headmasters' disapproval. Well, what about your families? Etta, what about you?
Well,
have I hit a nerve?
My father used to come every week and take me out. And he'd take me out for tea and buy me all sorts of nice things and all that. And he didn't like the idea that I was going with this person who was rather left-wing.
Oh, so it wasn't his blindness, it was his politics.
No, it was being left-wing. Talking about the Communist Party. And, no, he didn't like that.
Yes, my parents were both communists, you see, and I was very outspoken and at that time believed I was a communist, though I never actually joined the Communist Party. Your parents were relatively relaxed. I mean, you know, they knew about me. I couldn't possibly have told my mother that I had a girlfriend at the Royal Blind School. She was absolutely neurotic. I mean, the one thing that really... I mean, she was desperate for me to get back into education, and she did a very good job about fighting my corner in that respect. But the one thing that she did not like about the Royal Blind School was it was co-educational. And she dreaded that I might get in cahoots with a blind girl. Mm. And when she discovered that we had got together when we were about 20, she was furious. And I had a battle for 9 months with her over it. And finally she gave in because she saw there was nothing she could do about it.
What with jobs and a growing family... I mean, people, you could easily have settled for that. Most people would have thought that was more than enough for two blind people to cope with. Instead of which, you were both very active, Fred in national campaigns, both of you with the Reader's Service here in Kenilworth. And what was driving you, do you think?
What happened there was that Ted Herbert, a wonderful person in Kenilworth, ran the Coventry Careers Guidance Service. And he rang my doorbell one night. I didn't know him at that time. He rang my doorbell and he said, I've got a young chap who is trying to get into employment and I think it would help him if he had some voluntary work. I wonder if he'd come and read for you. And I said, well, Ted, to be honest, I've got as many readers as I can possibly cope with. And then a little light went on in my head and I said to him, but I tell you, there's an idea I've often had that a lot of people need things read to them other than academic things. And it would be just wonderful if there was some service that people could plug into and get a reader on demand, you know, to read their electric bills or their gas bills or birthday cards or postcards, whatever. I mean, there's Etta remembers and tells this wonderful illustrative story. Remember in Oxford, Etta?
Mrs. Lambert, yes.
The landlady.
Yes. Now, I think we'd only been there for a few days and I came back from work and she said, well, there's a postcard for you. I noticed it was from Edinburgh. I haven't read it. I've just put it on the hall table. And I said, well, I thought to myself, well, there can't be much on a postcard. So I said, oh, yeah, well, could you please read it to me, Mrs. Lambert? Oh, yes. Stories to hear you had having to pay such an extortionate rent. And she got, oh, she nearly exploded.
She went, oh.
I don't think you're paying an extortionate rent. And mind you, it was only £5 a week. Mm. And I don't really think, looking back on it, that it was an extortionate rent.
And it's the whole thing about privacy, isn't it? Basically,
yes,
need your privacy.
And it was a new, I mean, we didn't think of this at the time, but looking back on it, it was a new concept of voluntary action, because instead of a voluntary organisation saying, this is what we do for you and this is what you can have, we were saying, tell us what you want, tell us when you need a reader, what time you want a reader, and we'll provide the reader at the time that's convenient to you.
Yeah.
I mean, voluntary action has moved in that direction ever since, it seems to me. You now get trained with a guide dog from your home. You don't have to go to the guide dog centre.
And it's still running, isn't it?
It's still running here in Kenilworth, yeah.
Fred, you've said, you know, of all the things you've done, family is still absolutely crucial to you. Let's just get a sense of that. What was your house like with three young kids growing up?
Well, Etta, I really have to say, you know, she just was wonderful the way she took to running her house. You know, she's a great organiser and a great administrator, always has been. So was her mother, incidentally, as genetic. But she didn't faze her that she had three children under 16 months.
Because you had twins.
We had twins that's a second right, yeah. time, that's right. And she just got on with it. We rolled up our sleeves. I mean, although I was very busy in the first couple of years as a university lecturer, you're frantically preparing lectures all the time and you don't have a lot of spare time. But I had enough spare time to help a bit. And I used to make up 12 bottles every night so that Etta could feed the children right through the following day. Mm. And then Etta, she invented a way of going out with the children, with the twins, in their twin pushchair.
Well, the guide dog was guiding me along.
You pulled the pushchair behind you, didn't you?
Yes.
But the point is, the guide dog trainers had told you that you shouldn't do that. It couldn't be done, they said. And you
just did it. But no, we were fortunate that we bought the house, which was in a nice, quiet area.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were local shops very near, and I could go there with the twin pram. Mm. And Gavin, the little boy who was walking, he was ever so good. He kept beside me.
Mm-hmm.
He never ever tried to run away or anything like that.
Did they try and put one over on you as they got older? I mean, I've had kids as well, so I know.
I don't think, seriously, no. Julie's told stories about how, you know, they'd get a Milky Bar and put it in the shopping trolley without mum knowing and things like that. Little things like that. And Netta told the story about how she'd say to Julie, bring out the door to school, and Netta'd say, you got your coat on, Julie? Yes, mum, I've got my coat on, and shut the door quickly before mum could come and feel.
No, and this is when she was a bit older, by the way. This is when she was in secondary school. She would come with the coat on, and then she would say, oh, I'm just going back for something. And I knew that she was putting the coat back on the banister. And I said, well, all right, hell mind you then. If you get a bad cold, I won't be staying off work to look after you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's one of those things, I mean, sometimes people think very odd things about blind people, but one of the things that people are always amazed about when I talk to him is about couples who have, you know, blind couples mm-hmm. who have kids. They just don't seem to be able to get their heads around it. Do you understand that, Etta?
No.
I don't either.
No, I don't.
No. I mean, they're always going on. One of the questions they ask you over and over again, it must have been awful not to see your children. Now, of all the things that are lovable about children, millions of them, the things they say, the things they do. Well, yeah, of course you'd like to see them, but just go on about this one as though, you know, some sort of permanent sadness when you're actually full of the joys of parenthood. You don't pine and think, oh, you know, I wish I could see them. Yeah, fleetingly you might think that.
Well, but, we could imagine what they look like.
Etta, can I ask you about your music? That's quite important to you, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I still have a go at playing the piano, but I'm nothing like as good as what I was, I'm afraid. I did grade 8 when I was at school, and sometimes I didn't have a piano available. You know, when I was away in London, and when we first got married, we didn't have a piano. But somebody was going off to South Africa, and he said, oh, we've got a piano, you can have that. So that was terrific. So we had this piano given to us, which we had for quite a while.
Yeah, we had it for years and
Fred
years.
Fred brought me a new one. 40 years or so. When, what was it? Was it
it's
special?
For your 40th wedding anniversary, I bought you a new piano.
Question I do want to ask you both before we end. I mean, you have both been involved in so many aspects of public life and private life. You know, both know lots of visually impaired people. Do you think visually impaired people are better off now than in the past? And I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about lifestyle, about satisfaction.
No, some are, obviously. I mean, I use this expression, the blind elite, which I think is often misunderstood. People think I'm referring to an academic elite. I'm not. I just think that there are blind people whose qualities of endurance and stickability are so good that they cope with everything that life throws at them. But everybody isn't the same. And those kind of people get into the good jobs and they become admired and they get into leading positions and so forth. You know, the David Blunkets of this life. My dear friend Colin Lowe has come to mind as well. Well, but the majority of blind people are actually, A, the majority are old. B, of the younger groups, the majority have additional impairments. Often intellectual disabilities, and life for them, I think, is a pretty hard struggle, and they are not perceived by society as, you know, these remarkable people who do these remarkable things. They are a hidden majority who are kept out of sight and get a pretty hard deal. I always say, if you live long enough, you see progress. But God, you have to live a very long time.
Fred and Etta, a programme which turned out to be one of the most popular we'd ever done. Farewell, Fred, and thank you. If you have memories of Fred, maybe in his role as a sportsman, skier, mountaineer, tandem rider, then we'd like to hear from you. Next week, we'll be talking to the current CEO of the RNIB, Matt Stringer, about their strategy for the organisation's next 10 years. You can contact us by emailing in touch at bbc.co.uk or leave voice messages.